A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking what we actually mean when we say happiness. Are we talking about a fleeting good mood, deep life satisfaction, a sense of meaning, the absence of pain, or just raw pleasure? And then the harder question, can you actually measure it? Can you slap a number on someone's happiness in a way that's scientifically defensible? And if so, what's the criteria? Self-report surveys, brain chemistry, what people actually do, or how their lives turn out. Then he wants us to zoom out to the national level, have the experiments to benchmark countries by happiness instead of G. Actually produced anything useful? He mentions Bhutan's gross national happiness, the O Better Life Index, and especially the World Happiness Report, its Cantrell ladder method, and the consistent surprises in the rankings. Israel ranks startlingly high year after year, often top 5 or 10, despite, well, everything. He wants us to walk through plausible explanations for that, but also be honest about the methodological flaws, cultural reporting bias, the gap between life evaluation and daily affect, what these surveys actually capture versus what they miss, and then land on whether happiness economics is a useful corrective to G or just a soft metric dressed up as science. There's a lot to unpack here.
I love that he framed it as a thought challenge rather than a trick question, because it really isn't a trick. Philosophers have been chewing on this for 2.5 millennia, and we still don't have a settled definition. But the measurement piece is where it gets genuinely interesting, because the last 20 years have produced actual data, not just armchair theory.
By the way, quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, which feels appropriate for an episode about whether you can quantify the unquantifiable.
Alright, so let's start with the definition problem, because it's messier than most people realize. When Daniel asks whether happiness is momentary mood, life satisfaction, meaning, absence of suffering, or hedonic pleasure, the answer is that different researchers mean radically different things, and they often talk past each other. Psychologists usually split this into at least two buckets. One is hedonic happiness, raw pleasure, positive affect, feeling good right now. The other is eudaimonic happiness, from the Greek eudaimonia, which is more about flourishing, purpose, living a life that's worth living. Aristotle's version, essentially.
Those two can pull in completely opposite directions. Raising a newborn, miserable on the hedonic axis, at least at 3 a.m, but deeply meaningful on the eudaimonic one. So are you happy or not?
And that tension is why Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist who won a Nobel in economics, drew a sharp distinction between the experiencing self and the remembering self. The experiencing self lives moment to moment. The remembering self is the one that constructs a narrative about your life and answers survey questions, and they systematically disagree. Kahneman's classic example is the colonoscopy study. Patients who had a slightly longer procedure with a less painful ending remembered it as less unpleasant overall than patients who had a shorter procedure that ended at peak pain. The remembering self doesn't care about duration. It cares about peaks and endings.
Which is a terrifying thing to know about yourself. You're basically saying that if I want to remember my vacation as wonderful, I should make sure the last day is great, even if the middle was mediocre, and my future self will forgive the mediocrity.
Yes. And this has real implications for how we measure national happiness. When someone answers a life satisfaction question, they're consulting their remembering self. They're not averaging their moment-to-moment mood over the past year. They're constructing a narrative. And narratives are shaped by culture, by expectations, by what you think you're supposed to say.
All right, so let's get into the measurement piece properly. Daniel asks whether you can objectively score a person's happiness. Walk me through the actual tools researchers use.
There are broadly 4 approaches. One is self-report surveys, and that's the dominant method in happiness economics. The most famous is the Cantrell ladder, which is the backbone of the World Happiness Report. The question is basically, imagine a ladder with steps numbered 0 to 10, where 10 is the best possible life for you, and 0 is the worst. On which step do you feel you stand right now? That's it. Another approach is experience sampling. You ping people randomly throughout the day and ask how they're feeling right now. That captures the experiencing self rather than the remembering self. A third is neurochemical, cortisol for stress, serotonin and dopamine for positive states, though nobody's seriously proposing we run nationwide blood panels for happiness. And fourth is behavioral indicators, things like the suicide rate, antidepressant prescriptions, or even things like how often people smile in public.
The smile counting one feels like it would break immediately across cultures. A Finnish person not smiling doesn't mean they're miserable. They might just be Finnish.
That's exactly the problem. Every method has a cultural confound baked in. But let's talk about the Cantrell ladder specifically, because it's the one that generates the headlines. The World Happiness Report, which is published annually by the U. Sustainable Development Solutions Network, uses Gallup World Poll data, and the core dependent variable is the Cantrell ladder. They also look at six factors to explain the scores: G, per capita, social support, healthy life expectancy, freedom to make life choices, generosity, and perceptions of corruption. Those six factors typically explain about three-quarters of the variation across countries.
They're not measuring happiness directly. They're measuring life evaluation, how people rate their lives on a ladder, and then correlating that with a basket of explanatory variables.
And that distinction between life evaluation and emotional happiness is the single most important thing to understand about this whole field. The World Happiness Report does not measure how cheerful people feel day to day. It measures how they evaluate their lives when they stop and think about it. Those are correlated, but they're not the same thing. A country can score high on life evaluation while having relatively modest positive affect, and vice versa.
Which brings us to the Israel result, because this is where it gets puzzling. Israel has ranked in the top 10 of the World Happiness Report every year since it started. In 2023, it was fourth globally. In 2024, it was fifth. In 2025, it was eighth. This is a country with mandatory military service, a high cost of living, constant security threats, political turmoil that makes other democracies look tranquil. And yet, Israelis consistently report very high life satisfaction. What's going on?
The data on this is fascinating, and there are several overlapping explanations that the researchers have pointed to. The biggest single factor is social support. On the question of whether you have relatives or friends you can count on in times of trouble, Israel scores exceptionally high, among the highest in the world. Israeli society has very dense family networks, strong community bonds, and a culture where showing up for people is non-negotiable. When the report's authors drill into the Israel anomaly, they consistently point to social support as the primary driver.
That tracks anecdotally. There's a kind of tribal closeness here that's hard to explain to people who haven't experienced it. But it also makes sense in terms of the mechanism. If you believe people will catch you when you fall, you rate your life higher even if your circumstances are objectively difficult.
And the second factor is something the researchers call the shared purpose, or sense of meaning, dimension. Israel is a country where most people feel they're part of something larger than themselves, whether that's framed in religious terms, national terms, or both. The eudaimonic side of happiness is doing a lot of heavy lifting. People feel their lives matter, and that's not captured by G.
There's also a paradox here worth naming. Some researchers have suggested that adversity itself can boost life satisfaction under certain conditions, if people feel they're facing it together and it has meaning. Viktor Frankl's whole thing, essentially. Suffering with purpose is different from suffering without it.
Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning is the classic text on that, and it's been borne out in some modern research. But we should also be honest about a third factor that's less flattering, response bias. Israelis tend to express satisfaction in surveys in ways that might not perfectly map to their moment-to-moment experience. There's a cultural norm of positivity, or at least of not complaining to strangers with clipboards. Some researchers have noted that Israelis report high life satisfaction while simultaneously reporting high levels of stress, anxiety, and anger in daily affect measures.
They're telling the remembering self one story and the experiencing self another.
And that's not unique to Israel. It's a broader problem with cross-cultural survey research. Different cultures have different norms about what constitutes an appropriate answer. In some East Asian countries, there's evidence of a modesty bias that pushes self-reports downward. In some Latin American countries, there's a positivity bias that pushes them upward. The Cantrell ladder assumes that a 7 means the same thing to a farmer in Bhutan, a software engineer in Tel Aviv, and a retiree in Copenhagen. That's a heroic assumption.
Let's talk about Bhutan, since Daniel specifically mentioned it. Gross national happiness. This was the first serious attempt to say, gee, is the wrong yardstick. Let's build something better. What did they actually do?
Bhutan's experiment is important as a philosophical statement, even if the implementation has been messy. The term gross national happiness was coined by the fourth king of Bhutan, Jigme Singye Wangchuck, in the 1970s. He famously said that G is more important than G, but it wasn't formalized until much later. In 2008, Bhutan adopted a G index built around four pillars: sustainable and equitable socioeconomic development, environmental conservation, preservation and promotion of culture, and good governance. Those four pillars are broken down into 9 domains and 33 indicators, covering everything from psychological well-being and health to time use, cultural diversity, and community vitality.
33 indicators is a lot more than one ladder question.
It's vastly more comprehensive, and that's both its strength and its weakness. The strength is that it captures dimensions of well-being that G completely ignores, things like environmental quality, cultural participation, work-life balance. The weakness is that it's so complex that it's hard to compare across countries, hard to communicate to the public, and vulnerable to political manipulation. If the government controls which indicators are included and how they're weighted, G can become a propaganda tool rather than an objective measure.
Has Bhutan actually used it to guide policy?
To some extent, yes. Bhutan has made real policy choices that prioritize environmental conservation and cultural preservation over maximum economic growth. They've maintained forest cover above 60%. They've restricted mass tourism. They've been cautious about rapid urbanization. But Bhutan also scores relatively modestly on the World Happiness Report. In 2024, they ranked around 95th, which tells you something about the gap between a government-designed composite index and how people actually report feeling about their lives. The two measures are capturing different things.
Bhutan's G is more of a policy framework than a happiness thermometer.
It's a statement about what the government thinks should matter, not a direct readout of how people feel. And that's a recurring tension in this whole field. Is happiness economics about measuring subjective experience, or is it about building the normative framework for what a good society looks like? Those are different projects, and they sometimes get conflated.
What about the, Better Life Index? Daniel mentioned that one, too.
Launched the Better Life Index in 2011, and it's an interesting middle ground. It covers 11 dimensions: housing, income, jobs, community, education, environment, civic engagement, health, life satisfaction, safety, and work, life balance. What's clever about it is that it's interactive. You can go to the website and adjust the weightings yourself based on what you personally think matters most. It doesn't produce a single composite ranking. It lets users explore trade-offs. From a research perspective, that's both a feature and a bug. It's honest about the fact that weighting is inherently subjective, but it also means there's no single headline number to compete with G.
Which is partly why the World Happiness Report dominates the headlines. It gives you a clean ranking. Number 1, number 2, number 3. Journalists love that.
They absolutely do. And the ranking generates exactly the kind of water cooler conversation that spreads the report. Why are the Nordics always winning? Why is Costa Rica above the United States? Why is Afghanistan consistently last? The rankings are sticky. But the cost of that stickiness is that people treat the Cantrell ladder as if it's a happiness thermometer with meaningful cardinal properties, as if the difference between a 6.2 and a 6.4 is as real as the difference between a G. Growth rate of 2% and 3%. It's not.
Let's dig into that. What are the actual methodological critiques that serious researchers have leveled at the Cantrell ladder?
There are several. The first is the one we already mentioned, cultural response bias. Research by The Economist, Carol Graham, and others has shown that the same objective circumstances can produce systematically different self-reports in different cultures. Latin American countries consistently score higher than their G. Would predict East Asian countries often score lower. Some of that might be real differences in social support and community, but some of it is almost certainly cultural norms about how you answer questions about your life.
There's also the problem of adaptation. People in extremely difficult circumstances often report surprisingly high life satisfaction because they've adapted their expectations downward. If you've never known anything different, a 4 on the ladder might feel like an 8.
That's the second major critique, adaptation and changing reference points. Martha Nussbaum and Amartya Sen, who developed the capabilities approach, argued that subjective well-being measures are deeply problematic because people adjust their preferences to their circumstances. A woman in a highly patriarchal society might report being satisfied with her life because she's been socialized to expect very little. Is she truly happy, or has she just internalized depression? The Cantrell ladder can't distinguish between those two things.
That's the philosopher's objection, and it's a powerful one. Happiness surveys might end up measuring resignation rather than flourishing.
The third critique is about the gap between life evaluation and daily affect. The Gallup World Poll does ask about daily emotions. Did you smile yesterday? Did you feel worried? Did you experience enjoyment? And those measures sometimes produce very different rankings than the Cantrell ladder. Some countries that score high on life evaluation score much lower on positive daily affect. The remembering self and the experiencing self, again, the fourth, is about political manipulation. Once you declare that happiness is a national goal and you're going to measure it, governments have an incentive to manipulate the measurement. Maybe not directly cooking the numbers, though that's possible. But more subtly, by shaping what people think the right answer is. Public campaigns about how happy everyone is, pressure to report satisfaction, framing effects in how questions are asked. It's the Goodhart's Law problem. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
Goodhart's Law is practically the theme music of this podcast at this point. Alright, so we've got a single self-report question that's vulnerable to cultural bias, adaptation effects, the remembering, experiencing gap, and political manipulation. And yet, the World Happiness Report is treated as serious social science by serious people. Why should we take it seriously at all?
Because, for all its flaws, it's capturing something real. The rankings are remarkably stable year to year. The six-factor model explains about 3/4 of the cross-country variation, which is actually quite good for social science. The Nordic countries don't dominate by accident. They have strong social safety nets, low inequality, high trust, and high social support. The countries at the bottom, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Sierra Leone, are suffering from war, poverty, and institutional collapse. The measure is noisy, but the signal is real.
The U.S. slide. Daniel mentioned that. What's happening there?
The United States has been drifting downward in the rankings for about a decade. In 2024, it fell out of the top 20 for the first time, landing at 23rd. In 2025, it dropped further to 24th. The report's authors point to several drivers: declining social support among the young, rising perceptions of corruption, and a particularly striking drop in well-being among Americans under 30. There's a generational fracture opening up. Older Americans still report relatively high life satisfaction, but younger Americans are reporting levels more typical of much poorer countries.
That's alarming. A 25-year-old in the U.S. reporting life satisfaction comparable to someone in a middle-income developing country? That's not just a statistical curiosity. That's a social fabric problem.
It connects to something we've talked about before, the limits of G as a proxy for well-being. The U.S. still has the world's largest economy. Per capita G is among the highest in the world. And yet, on life evaluation, it's sliding. That's exactly the kind of divergence that motivated the happiness economics movement in the first place. Rich countries were getting richer, but not getting happier.
That's the Easterlin paradox, right?
Yes, named after Richard Easterlin, who found in 1974 that within a country, richer people are happier than poorer people, but across countries and over time, rising national income doesn't seem to produce rising happiness. The paradox has been debated for 50 years. Some researchers, like Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson, have argued that the paradox doesn't hold, that there is a clear log-linear relationship between income and well-being across countries, and richer countries really are happier. Others maintain that beyond a certain threshold, somewhere around $15,000 to $20,000 per capita, additional income has rapidly diminishing returns for well-being.
Where do you land on that?
I think the evidence now leans toward a nuanced middle ground. Absolute income matters a lot when you're poor. Moving from subsistence to basic security produces enormous well-being gains. Beyond that, relative income starts to matter more. It's not just how much you have, it's how much you have compared to the people around you. And that's where G-growth can become a treadmill. Everyone runs faster, but nobody gets ahead relative to their neighbors. The well-being gains evaporate.
If I'm a policymaker, and I've absorbed all this, the strengths and the weaknesses, shall I be steering by happiness metrics instead of G? Is happiness economics a useful corrective, or just soft metrics in a lab coat?
I think the honest answer is that it's a useful corrective, but not a replacement. It was never designed to measure well-being. It was designed to measure economic output, and it does that reasonably well. The mistake was using it as a proxy for national success. Happiness metrics provide a crucial second lens. Is growing, but life satisfaction is falling. That's a signal that something is going wrong in how the gains are being distributed or how they're translating into lived experience. You want both measures on the dashboard, not one replacing the other.
The dashboard metaphor is right. You don't fly a plane by watching only the altimeter or only the fuel gauge. But I do think there's a danger in overcorrecting, in treating happiness as if it's the ultimate metric and everything else is instrumental to it. Some things are worth doing even if they don't show up in happiness surveys.
That's the eudaimonic point again. Raising children might not maximize your moment-to-moment positive affect. Defending your country might not either. Creating great art often involves misery. If we optimize purely for self-reported life satisfaction, we might end up with a society that's very pleasant but also very shallow. John Stuart Mill made this point. It's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. The happiness economists aren't all utilitarians, but the framework does have a utilitarian flavor that can flatten important distinctions.
Where does this leave us with Daniel's original question? What do we actually mean by happiness?
I think the most honest answer is that we mean several different things, and we should stop pretending they're all the same thing. Momentary pleasure, life satisfaction, sense of meaning, absence of suffering. These are distinct phenomena that are loosely correlated but can diverge dramatically. The World Happiness Report measures one of them, life evaluation, reasonably well, with caveats. But it doesn't measure happiness in the full rich sense of the word, and we shouldn't treat it as if it does.
The Israel result. I think the most plausible explanation is that strong social bonds and a sense of shared purpose do produce high life evaluation, even in difficult circumstances. But we should also hold open the possibility that some of it is cultural response style, and that daily emotional experience might tell a more complicated story.
I'd add one more layer. Israel is also a country with very high fertility rates by developed country standards, around 3 children per woman. That's a demographic outlier. And having children, despite the day-to-day stress, tends to be associated with higher life evaluation in the long run, even if it depresses momentary happiness. The eudaimonic-hedonic gap again. So the fertility rate might be both a cause and a consequence of the social support structure that drives the happiness score.
That's a connection I hadn't made. The same dense family networks that make people feel supported also make them more likely to have larger families, which reinforces the networks. It's a virtuous cycle, at least from a life evaluation perspective.
And it's worth noting that this pattern isn't unique to Israel. The Nordic countries also have strong social support, but theirs is more institutional, through the welfare state, whereas Israel's is more interpersonal, through family and community. Different mechanisms, similar outcome on the Cantrell ladder. That suggests there are multiple paths to high life evaluation, which is actually encouraging from a policy perspective.
One last thing I want to touch on. Daniel asked about neurochemistry and behavioral indicators as alternative measurement approaches. Are those going anywhere?
Neurochemistry is fascinating, but nowhere near ready for population-level measurement. We can measure cortisol in hair samples as a proxy for chronic stress, and we can do functional M. Studies of brain activity associated with positive and negative affect. But the variation across individuals is enormous, the cost is prohibitive, and the ethical questions are thorny. Do we really want governments measuring citizens' stress hormones? Behavioral indicators are more promising. Things like suicide rates, antidepressant use, alcohol consumption, even Google search data for terms associated with distress. Those are already being used by some researchers as objective complements to self-report data. But they measure misery more than happiness. You can be not depressed without being happy.
The self-report survey, flawed as it is, remains the least bad option for now.
And the Cantrell ladder, for all its problems, has one huge advantage. It's simple, it's fast, and it's been asked consistently across more than 150 countries for nearly 2 decades. That longitudinal dataset is valuable, even if each individual data point is noisy. When you see a trend over 15 years across 100,000 respondents, the noise averages out and the signal emerges.
We're stuck with the ladder, but we should climb it with our eyes open.
And I think that's the right note to end the substantive discussion on. Happiness economics is real, it's useful, it's advancing, but it's not a solved problem. Treat it as a corrective to G-monomania, not as a replacement for it. And always ask which happiness you're measuring.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Greenland shark can live for over 400 years and doesn't reach sexual maturity until around age 150.
There's a shark out there that was alive during the 30 Years' War and still hasn't settled down.
That's going to sit with me.
The question we'll leave listeners with. If we did manage to build a perfect happiness metric tomorrow, one that captured hedonic pleasure, life satisfaction, and eudaimonic meaning all in a single defensible number, would we actually want our governments optimizing for it? Or is there something about the pursuit of happiness that requires it to remain a pursuit, not a target? Something to chew on. Thanks as always to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify.
We'll be back next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.